On today's episode, we talk about the Marlins and Wei-Yin Chen's injury. We talk about the Mariners and their slow descent into madness. But the show really goes off the rails near the end as each of the three of us share our favorite Adam Rosales moment. Yep, you heard that right. We're celebrating the fourth anniversary of the home run that wasn't, and Adam shows his utility by both pitching and taking a position upstairs. It's the DFA Podcast. Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grossnick of BP, and joining me, as always, is my co-host RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, and also Sean Brody, our producer, I have a big question for you guys before we get into the good stuff, the real Major League Baseball stuff today. I do need a piece of advice, and given that RJ, you're a professional baseball writer, and Sean, you're a college baseball pitcher, I need some help from you guys. Today's my first slow pitch softball game in like almost 10 years. Any tips for me for tonight and getting back into the swing of things, so to speak?
Yes, make sure you bring your Windex. That is a wonder drug.
Windex?
Okay, I don't think you've seen My Big Fat Greek Wedding, but yes, that's a reference from there. But don't hurt yourself, Brian. Don't hurt yourself.
Take it from me, hurting yourself in baseball is not very fun.
Yeah, I would not want to be in your Tommy John surgery situation at all, Sean. So thanks for that advice. So, although hopefully I would think throwing underhand would not be too much of a strain on my UCL, but who knows?
You get a cool little scar afterwards, though.
very cool scar. Yeah, my wife chick stick scars, so maybe my wife would go for that. So let's get to some more serious talk, I guess. Nobody wants to hear about my beer league softball team. Let's talk about Major League Baseball. We've got a lot to talk about today. There have been a lot of minor moves across MLB, and we're going to get into them. But for our big move today, I think we'll talk about a move that's maybe not as big as last show, where we talked about Cole Hamels hitting the DL and torpedoing the Rangers' chances for this year. This time we'll talk about another starting pitcher and another injury, but maybe not quite as important as Hamels. Our big move for today is the Marlins' Wei-Yin Chen going to the disabled list. He's hitting the 10-day DL, and that's another blow for a Marlins team that really probably doesn't need it. RJ, tell me a little bit about Chen and how this you think is going to affect the Marlins going forward.
Well, he's their third starting pitcher on the disabled list now, joining Locke and Volquez, which is obviously not a great situation for a team that entered the year without a whole lot of starting pitching depth. And Chen specifically, you know, last season he had a weird year because he missed time with an elbow issue. I believe he recently said that he's pitching with a partially torn UCL, so that's encouraging. but, you know, last season he had obviously signed with the Marlins during the winter to kind of be a boring middle-of-the-rotation stalwart. He missed that time. He had, like, outstanding peripherals. I mean, a 4.17 strikeout-to-walk ratio was a career best for him. However, he allowed too many home runs, too many hits, and that led to a 4.96 ERA or an 80 ERA plus, which is the first time in his career that he had finished below 100. This season, the walk rate is up, the home runs and hits are down, and the strikeout rate is also down. And he'd been a little bit more effective. You know, this Marlins team just couldn't afford to lose another piece, especially when he's sort of the safe veteran now. Like, Volquez is a little more volatile for me. So, Chen was kind of – he went from the mid-rotation guy to, like, the staff ace, essentially, which is a concerning thing to begin with. But now that he is out, the rotation has Straley, Kohler, Conley, and Urena, who filled in this weekend. And – that's not a good group. This was a team that entered the year, you know, bullpen dependent. And right now they are so dependent on that bullpen, it's not even funny.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, they've got a great bullpen and that's a nice thing to have. But boy, this rotation is really ugly. And Chen, like you said, was kind of the ace of this rotation by default, I guess, because he's got the track record of being at least a little bit above average. He is not what you'd consider a front of the rotation starter, even at his best, because he doesn't have the swing and miss stuff. And it's a pretty rough situation now. And I mean, when you say like, oh no, it's terrible, Jeff Locke and Edinson Volquez are on the disabled list, now we got to go with the guys behind them. I mean, that's pretty rough. I mean, you don't think that a team like the Marlins can really compete, maybe even with those guys. And with Chen going down in his 5-year, $80 million contract, it's a big blow for this team. So do you think there's anything for the Marlins to look forward to in the guys who are going to come up to replace Chen in the rotation or replace even Volquez? Or do you think this is just going to be one of those things where they have to pull somebody in who's not going to be very exciting, no upside kind of moves?
I think it's going to be the latter. I mean, if you just look at their Triple-A depth chart, they have Justin Nicolino, who he's not pitching well in Triple-A, and he hasn't shown that his changeup heavy approach is going to work in a big league rotation. They have Despain, who, nope. They have Vance Worley. You know, he's shown some effectiveness in the past, but the upside is kind of limited there. And then they also have some names who might be familiar to those who consistently read the transaction analysis column and have a thing for fringe pitchers. And Scott Copeland, you might remember from the Blue Jays, and Stephen Fife, who years and years ago was a thing with the Dodgers. So, no, there's really not a whole lot of upside coming. The good news, I guess, is that Don Mattingly has said that he only expects Chen to miss a start, same with Volquez, and Jeff Locke is continuing to build up his arm strength. He's dealing with shoulder tendonitis, but he continues to work towards his own return. So help is on the way, but the help is not going to change the Marlins' fate either. It's just going to make them more manageable to watch, and that's about it.
So looking at this Marlins team, I mean, you've got to assume that these kinds of shorter term injuries like the ones to Volquez and Chen are going to be, you know, kind of par for the course for most teams over the course of a season. I think it kind of goes almost without saying that the big hit that the Marlins took was the loss of Jose Fernandez last year and how that dramatically changed this outlook for this team, the rotation. I mean, we didn't really want to talk about how Fernandez's passing might have affected the Marlins as a team last year because it was raw, because it was, I wouldn't have considered it too appropriate to really dwell on that for most of the offseason. But now that there's been some time and some space with it, I think it's worth talking about what exactly kind of hole this makes for a team and how irreplaceable, just from a on-field value perspective, a player like that is, because he's not something you can replace even in the best of situations. I mean, teams go crazy trying to find front-of-the-rotation starters, but especially for a team like the Marlins, which doesn't have a lot of luck in free agency, the trades that they've made in the past aren't particularly compelling, and the draft has been a complete disaster for them more or less over the last few years. Do you think that this the loss of Fernandez is going to be one of those things that prevents the Marlins from actually, you know, being one of those wild card borderline contention teams? Or do you think that even if he was still available and pitching and that kind of thing, that the Marlins would still be as hard pressed as they are now, I guess?
I think he would have changed their entire dynamic. Anytime you add, like you said, anytime you have a front of the rotation starter like that, it makes everything look better, and it would have probably changed what they did this offseason in a positive way. And, I mean, just the cascading effect, if you're going bullpen heavy, having that ace who can go 7-8 innings consistently allows you to be more aggressive with your bullpen instead of trying to cover 4-plus innings every single day like they're having to do now, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll just plug Emma Bacciolari's essay from the BP Annual, which is really, really good. She covered the Fernandez passing as well as I've seen anyone cover it. And yeah, this was more than a ball player, more than, you know, just on field production. So it's like you said, it's really difficult to talk about him just from an on the field perspective. But yeah, I mean, it's a huge hit for them, and it's unfortunate in many regards. And one of the smaller regards is that it probably did sink their chances of competing with this core.
Sure. Sure. So looking at Chen, looking at his, up until the minute the Marlins signed him, he was kind of a stable, reliable left-handed starter, and it would have been good for maybe two wins every year was kind of the idea. After last year, where he wasn't as effective and was injured, now this year he's got a little bit of an injury issue and hasn't been as effective. The Marlins really don't have any stable forces in their rotation. So, I mean, how do you think a team like this should go about trying to recover and rebuild? I know they're in flux with the possible purchase of the team to Derek Jeter and Jeb Bush or maybe somebody else. I don't know how a team like this would try to rebuild a rotation when it seems like they have so many parts that are not stable going forward.
Well, I think we saw what their thoughts on it were this offseason when they went out and they signed Ziegler and they signed Tozawa to add them to Ramos, Bearclaw, and Phelps. It seems like they were thinking, let's be even new Orioles, let's be even the new Royals, to the extent that if it had worked, we'd be talking about, of course it worked. They're smart. They have Jason Parra, BP alum running their, analytics department. So of course they're smart. It's difficult because you don't necessarily want to go out and pay market value for mid-rotation starters, especially when you're the Marlins, and especially when you're facing a free agent class like they did last winter. So from the sense that if they're going to try to compete, and if you have that lineup, you might as well try to compete. I guess what they did was perhaps the most logical route, sign or take some bets on veterans who are cheap, but who might have a little bit of upside remaining. I mean, Volquez, he's pulled out solid years before. Locke has been effective at times. Straley, again, he's been effective at times. Even the guys they had in-house, Conley looked like a really good pitcher at times last season. And Kohler in the past has, sort of drawn poor man John Lackey comparisons. I don't know how much of that is just being a tall and well-built right-hander with a curveball, but he's had some support in recent years. So I think going bullpen heavy was sort of their answer to how do we rebuild this rotation after losing Fernandez. Now, whether it's the smart strategy, whether Ziegler and Tozawa were ever going to be enough to give them that, cheat code at the end of the game that the Royals and Orioles have had, that's up for debate. But I think that's what we saw, them examining their situation, especially with regards to the rotation, and saying this is the best possible route for us to take right now. And it hasn't worked out, but I guess I can admire the creativity there and admire the logic, assuming that that was their idea and they just didn't decide, let's go get, let's go build up our bullpen just because,
Sure. And I definitely respect that as a decision to make for a short-term move. But I'm concerned, relievers are notoriously volatile. And the talent that the Marlins have collected at the back of their bullpen, with guys like Tozawa and Ziegler, you can't really expect them to continue to be effective relievers indefinitely. Maybe you can with AJ Ramos. Maybe you can with Kyle Bearclaw if he ever figures out how to stop walking people, even just a little bit. But it's not like the Royals in which they had this dominant back of the bullpen who are all young guys, in like a Davis and Herrera, and it's not like the Orioles where they have a Zach Britton type closer at the back of it. So I just kind of wonder if this season seemed like it might have been the, all right, we're going to make one last push for the wild card, and yes, we don't have a great rotation, but we'll bolster our bullpen and we'll just see what kind of comes of it. And I just have a lot of concern that if they try to run this back again next year, it's going to be one of those things where the bullpen's going to be slightly worse, the rotation might be slightly worse, which is saying something, and then there's really no hope. So I kind of wonder if this might be the season in which it might behoove the Marlins to maybe move one of their outfielders and try to bring back some young talent and, kind of bolster the farm system, or at least get a young starter that's not necessarily in that Dan Straley mode, but maybe somebody with a little bit higher upside, to try to make a push for the future rather than kind of clinging to this hope that they can sneak into the wild card.
I agree with that, but I mean, you have to keep in mind, not every team can really expect to build like a 3 to 5 year dynasty here. Some teams are
Sure.
just hoping to get in one time. You know, all these long playoff streaks, they begin with one appearance. So you never know. You make one appearance and, you know, sometimes fate shines on you. Sometimes fortune shines on you. Excuse me. Well, I guess fate does too, but that's a topic for another day.
So, yeah, so the Marlins not looking great, but at least they can beat up on the Mets like the rest of the league. That game last night was pretty bad. 7.5 games behind the Nationals to start, 4 games below 500, but still not as bad as some of the other teams in the National League East, which is saying something, I guess. So moving on to our second topic for today, we'll talk about one of those teams that, unlike the Marlins, has really gone down the tubes. For a change, it won't be in the Mets. I know we like to kind of talk about how much of a dumpster fire the Mets are, but there is a new contender for team most likely causing its fan base to panic these days. The American League West, we will go back to the Mariners. Subject of discussion on previous episodes for their many, many changes to the roster. Well, now it's time for them to have made a few more changes. Starting pitcher James Paxton, the leading light for the Mariners this season, has gone to the disabled list. Mike Zunino, catcher who very talented and when he was drafted, we thought he might be a real, you know, perhaps maybe an all-star level catcher, but at least a solid regular, has been demoted back to AAA Tacoma. And things are looking really, really dark in Seattle. RJ, what is going on over there? And is this really kind of the worst case scenario for this team at this point?
Yeah, if not, it's getting pretty close to it. You know, Greece is not the word anymore in Seattle. It's whatever the inverse of Greece is. You know, and Zunino, that's a double shot. Because for one thing, it's not like Carlos Ruiz or Tuffy Goes, which are playing well or are likely to play well. You know, Zunino, he had like a 40 OPS plus, but that's better than Ruiz had. And it's probably not too far off from what Goes, which will produce. So you could actually argue that as bad as he's been, he might be their best option behind the plate still. But the other part of that that's concerning is, I mean, at what point do you just give up on him? He's 26 years old. This is part of his fifth big league season. And outside of those 200 plate appearances last season, he's never hit. Now, can he frame? Yes. But it seems like Seattle is not content with him just framing, which is fine. You know, we've gotten to the point where, you know, if a guy frames, it seems like we forgive all his offensive sins. But if he can't frame, we don't care how much he hits. And for proof of that, look at JT Realmuto in Miami. Mm-hmm. You know, he can hit, but everybody's like, well, he can't frame. So, and in Zunino's case, to his credit, you know, he has gotten more patient at the plate, a little bit more selective. But there's just so much swing and miss there that you have to hit for power. You have to draw some walks because he's never going to hit for average. And I don't know, at this point, you know, there were comparisons on draft day to Mike Lieberthal. He's clearly not going to be that good. And you have to just figure out, like, the form he's taking, a guy who's not going to give you much offense, but he might have these little surges of power every now and then. You know, is he a guy who you can accept and use as your backup? Or are they just going to get rid of him because he's a, you know, a ghost of better hopes? Or, you know, I don't know there, but I do know the James Paxton injury is just killer for them because they've already dug into the rotation depth a few times this season, and they're going to be starting, what, Chase DeJong and Dylan Overton? I mean, that's awful. And the big question with that rotation entering the year was about durability and about volatility, and here we are early May, and Felix Hernandez is on the disabled list, Drew Smiley's on the disabled list, and now Big Maple. I just – there's not a lot going for this team that's positive right now. And, you know, I mean, they're almost 500, so that's the bright side. But other than that, oh, boy.
Yeah, that's the thing, that despite all of these injuries and, you know, a really kind of a full collapse from some perspectives, they've acquitted themselves okay up to this point. They're not so far out of it that they will never be able to recover from this if things start turning their way. But, you know, they're still ahead of the Athletics, ahead of the Rangers, which I'm not sure anybody would have expected, and just a half game behind the Angels in the AL West. I think the problem is that the AL West, the top of the AL West, may be out of reach. I think the Astros may already be putting this division and the other teams in it well in the rearview mirror, so they'd be competing for a wild card spot.
Famous last words.
Yeah, right.
Division race, nearly May. Oh boy.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and call that. I feel confident enough there, but you know, I'm also wrong all the time. But there's a possibility that the Astros could just run away with this at this point. I want to talk a little bit about Zunino and his framing for a minute, because last year he teased us. He hit well enough last year to make you think that perhaps he had turned a corner. Despite striking out like a third of the time, he hit for enough power that he was a functional offensive player. And the framing is always the defense, and the pitch framing has always been kind of the calling card for his major league career. Now his offense has regressed. He still is a plus framer. But one of the things that I'm kind of curious about is if now that so many teams are focusing on framing, and it seems as if catchers are getting better across the league at framing, I wonder if that skill is no longer as valuable as it might have been in previous years when teams were really, you know, trying to jump out there and get the Jose Molinas and the Rene Riveras of the world into the lineup. Now that everybody's getting a little bit better, maybe Zunino doesn't have the same kind of defensive value that he did before, just because the average performance and framing in the league is so much better. And if that's the case, and Zunino is striking out now almost 40% of the time, which is probably an unforgivable number no matter how hard you hit a ball when you put it in play, maybe that's a reason why the team feels they might need to move on, despite, you know, Carlos Ruiz and Tuffy Goswich, like you mentioned before, they are not good options. He's not blocking anybody, for sure.
Right. And to your point, I think framing kind of jumped the shark, so to speak, when the Twins went out and paid Jason Castro. Because at that point, framing wasn't just something that you kind of get for free, like as an add-on to signing all these solas for the league minimum or whatever. Now it's something that teams seem to be valuing to the extent that they're actually paying market value for it. And that would be the time where I would say, yeah, we're not focused on that anymore. Let's find the next inefficiency or the next skill that's not being valued properly or what have you. And your point about how, you know, teams are identifying better framers and employing them and all, and therefore, you know, it's basically the ocean level has, you know, risen on what it is an acceptable framer anymore. And maybe that's why some of these stalwarts of framing, like Jonathan Lucroy and Yadier Molina, have seen their framing numbers come down, because we're comparing it to average, and the average has increased. So it's not that they've gotten worse. It's just that relative to average, they're no longer, you know, two or three standard deviations away or whatever it was, you know? So that's a really good point. And yeah, maybe they're sending Zunino down hoping that this is the time he goes to AAA, he makes some adjustments, and he comes back and he doesn't strike out 40% of the time or even 35% of the time. And maybe he develops enough of an offensive game where he's not just a catch and throw guy. He's, I mean, not Miguel Olivo, but, you know, a little bit more, I guess I would say, special compared to the fungible third catcher types. I mean, Luke Maley, we talked about him last week. Mm. What is he? A catch and throw guy. You know,
right.
What are 99% of the guys available on waivers who are catchers, catch and throw guys? So, yeah, maybe they're just hoping that something clicks and he turns into more than a catch and throw guy. But it seems very unlikely at this point.
Sure. And, you know, he's 26. And yes, of course, catcher bats develop later. And yes, of course, Zunino was a college catcher, not necessarily, you know, one of those high profile, really young high school guys coming into the draft. So maybe there is still room left for him to continue to develop. The other thing I'm going to throw out here now is that I'm not sure that a team like the Mariners would benefit as much from having a high impact framer behind the dish as perhaps a team with a younger pitching staff. I kind of have, and this is just kind of anecdotal at this point, but I'm starting to think that it might be better if you have to punt some of your offense for defense behind the plate. I'm starting to think it might be better to have that on a younger roster where the young pitchers might be able to develop some confidence if they get a few extra strikes here and there. I know there's been a lot of research about, you know, what kinds of pitchers benefit better from good framing. And the Mariners, with their kind of veteran staff, I mean, Iwakuma, Hernandez, those are guys who don't really need confidence boosts. And then Drew Smyly, Paxton probably could have used it, but Paxton is, when he is able to pitch, is throwing so hard and so well that it kind of doesn't matter who's back there. You could put Ryan Domet back there and he'd still probably be effective. I kind of wonder if maybe it's a different sort of need that the Mariners need to fill. Maybe, you know, more of an AJ Ellis game caller type might be useful. Maybe somebody who can actually, you know, hit, get the ball in play once in a while would be more useful. And maybe somebody like Zunino might fit better with a little bit younger pitching staff or something like that.
That's interesting, too, because Zunino is 26. You don't necessarily think of him as like a game caller, or, you know, a game general or whatever you want to call it, but a field general, excuse me. But yeah, that's an interesting theory. And you can kind of, it makes sense. Like if you have a young rotation where the members of it are perhaps nibbling, you know, not trusting their stuff, to have a guy who can help them avoid falling behind 2-0 every batter, you know, that would make sense. I would be interested in the numbers on that, but obviously, you know, it's kind of hard to finagle into a usable study. And isn't that baseball, basically? You come up with an interesting theory, and then it's like, I would love to see what this results in, and it's basically impossible to do. You know, one thing, I mean, this reminds me, like a couple years ago, I wanted to do a study on whether turf led to outfielders getting injured more or, you know, losing their speed or whatever, because, you know, that's the anecdotal thing. You look at the Rays, you know, Carl Crawford, BJ Upton, even Desmond Jennings. So I wanted to, you know, do a study on that. And then it's like, yeah, there's really no way to do this study and have it mean anything whatsoever. So that's baseball for you. Even when you have a good idea, a good study idea, it's basically impossible to pull off. So thank you, baseball.
Yeah.
Keeping us.
Yeah, right. If there's someone much smarter than us listening and thinking that maybe you can figure out.
Oh, there is. If there's one person listening, Brian, we hear definitely.
He's probably
second, third. Elliot the cat is listening. So yes, we hear definitely second and third.
Yeah. Well, Elliot, run the numbers on this. Get back to us. Let us know. The Paxton side of this is just, you know, that terrible, unfortunate thing in baseball now where it's, you see a guy who has a velocity jump or is really exciting to watch, has phenomenal stuff, and then immediately seems to get injured. Between Paxton and Syndergaard, kind of two of the most dynamic, fun to watch starting pitchers in each league, going down with these kind of hopefully not serious, but in Paxton's case, you know, you hear the forearm injury and you shudder to think that it might mean something like a UCL scare. I almost feel bad now whenever I get excited watching a guy with a filthy breaking pitch and throwing 97 plus. Are you kind of feeling the same way? Like, I almost don't want pitchers to throw this hard now, even though it's so much fun to watch, because I'm just terrified they're going to be injured all the time.
Yeah, and I would note that Paxton has had durability issues even before he changed his mechanics and became, you know, this consistent. Yeah, so this is not something that just popped up for him, but I definitely empathize with your point here. It's like, you know, like you said, Syndergaard, you watch him, he's a freaking video game character. And in the back of your head, you're like, this is probably just a transient thing. You know, he's probably not going to be doing this 30 times a year for the next 10 years or even the next 5 years. And I don't know, is it a new phenomenon, or are we just more in tune with it now because of, you know, Jeff Passan's the arm, and because, you know, we see every single report as soon as it comes out, basically, you know, oh, this guy's going for an MRI now. I think the numbers do spell out that there are more Tommy John surgeries, but in terms of perhaps it happening, I don't know. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, maybe we're so focused on this that it's harder to shake the feelings because of that. Like, we're a little bit more, maybe we're seeking confirmation bias. Like, you know, the next young stud pitcher comes up, he's throwing 98 consistently. He's touching 98 consistently. It's like, yeah, he's going to get hurt. And then he gets hurt. And we're like, yeah, see, every guy gets hurt, you know, whether it's Jose Fernandez, Syndergaard, whomever. And yeah, I guess I am. I guess I do feel that way. And it's unfortunate. And yeah, I mean, it almost creates, not to the same extent, but it's almost like why you can't watch football, you know, like the concussions. It's almost like that. Like, you don't almost want to see a kid pitching or have you, because you don't want them to get hurt. And obviously, you know, you'd rather suffer an arm injury than a concussion. But the point is, yeah, there's a little bit of guilt baked into seeing these high octane fastballs out of the rotation. And I thought John Smoltz had an interesting comment. I think it was a week ago now. He said because pitchers are redlining constantly, he believes that's leading to the injuries. He's like, you know, you don't want to redline a car constantly, or otherwise, yeah, your engine's going to blow. So I don't know how much validity there is to that, but I thought it was interesting, and it's something to keep in mind as we become more and more velocity obsessed, especially as it pertains to starting pitchers.
Yeah, and I think there's that, and I know that Kyle Boddie and what he's doing at Driveline, there's this push in some pitching circles to throw hard and have a very strong intent to throw hard to try to develop velocity. Right. And there's a part of me that really agrees with that and feels like that's probably a really, really smart path to take for development, especially with my background in training and development. I really tend to agree with that kind of logic from my, you know, kind of outsider perspective. I wonder if this idea of redlining and maybe waiting until too late in the development process, maybe there are pitchers who aren't redlining enough in the past, and then, you know, now that they're asked to do this on the biggest stage, or they tweak their mechanics, or they're called up, and now maybe they're trying to throw harder than they ever have before, or they had coaches or somebody telling them, preventing them from trying to throw as hard as possible consistently in the past. Maybe that's an effect. There's just so many moving parts here. And of course, it's going to be different for every pitcher too. I mean, some guys are going to be able to take the strain of trying to throw at max effort every fifth day or something like that. And some guys just aren't going to be built like that. But I mean, there's just so many kind of open questions about also, you know, what's the right path for each of these guys. And I just don't know how you'd figure out what's right for a particular guy fast enough to find something that works. You almost kind of have to luck into it. Maybe Paxton's a guy who should have been trying to throw with these mechanics his whole life, and we just, you know, never kind of discovered it until now, and then he kind of unluckily falls into an injury rut. You know, it's just right. It's so wild to think that there are so many different ways to go about this, so many possible right ways or wrong ways, and then, you know, kind of in the end everybody gets injured.
Yeah, and it kind of makes you happy that your job is not a general manager's. Like, think about all the, like, you know, just employing the right player developmental people. Like, you don't really know if they're the right player development people. And oh, yeah. You know, we're talking about here, like, you don't know necessarily if a guy can handle the max effort stuff and on. If your job, you know, was dependent on making these decisions and having your underlings make these right decisions every single day or every single season, I mean, yeah, I think that would drive me insane. I think, you know, I think there's a point there where it's like, this is too much stress on me. It's too much chaos, basically. You know, you're just hoping to win the lottery with a few times a year, basically, with these mechanical changes and all. And yeah, it's, yeah, I don't even know how you would begin to study that stuff other than just mass amounts of data and hoping that you can figure out the micro cases where the mass, where the macro does not apply to the micro. And even that, I mean, good luck, right?
Yeah, for sure. And this is one of the reasons why I think that there's this big public gap between folks knowing what, like, for example, baseball operations folks do, but the player development side of things, I really think, gets glossed over quite a bit. Yeah. In terms of who's doing it, what they're doing, and why they're doing it. I know player development's kept very close-lipped in a lot of teams' cases, even more so than some stuff on the operations side. But I mean, my hat's off to anybody who works in development and really is pushing to try to figure out some of these things, because right now I think most of us in the public sphere don't have the slightest idea who these guys are, what they're doing, what goes into this effort of that. And hopefully that's something we can see changed in the future. But man, that's a tough job.
Yeah. And it's a good reminder. Don't get too rigid in your beliefs, because
yes.
Right. I mean, you see it now, even with the analytics stuff, like, you know, velocity is good, but you know, there's going to be exceptions where a guy's going to throw 92 and still be successful. And I mean, the thing right now that pops to mind is the fly ball stuff. Like, everybody's saying, oh, hit the ball in the air, hit the ball in the air. Like, you don't want Billy Hamilton hitting the ball in the air, you know? So there's always going to be exceptions, and there's always going to be cases where the convention does not apply. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. And otherwise, I mean, you're being no better than the people who said, you know, oh, analytics have no place, or, you know, this or that. tweak has no place or what have you. So yeah, definitely stay flexible with your belief system, especially when it comes to mechanical stuff, and especially when it comes to, you know, tactical ideas and whatnot.
Amen, brother. So yeah, we'll keep rooting for Jared Weaver. I guess we'll blow off the guys who are throwing 97 for a little while. Yes.
Andrew Triggs. Yes, we are your biggest fans, Andrew Triggs. Keep doing you. Fly, Seagull, fly.
And Jared Weaver, just for an update, is now striking out 4.4 batters per nine and has an FIP of 7.44. So that's the kind of baseball we're looking for. Democratic, no strikeouts. Every ball gets into play, and the Padres lose again. So that'll do it for our main blocks of the show. We'll jump into some quick hits. We'll bring Sean back in, and we'll cover some of the other moves in the league over the last few days. So, Sean, take us to batting practice.
So to start this batting practice segment, we have three disabled list stints. The first one's going to be Brett Anderson on the 10-day disabled list with a lower back strain. What does this mean for the fifth position in the Cubs rotation? Is it Mike Montgomery? Is it someone else? And how does that play into last night's 18-inning game?
Well, it's not good. But Anderson has been so bad. He started off the season allowing one run over his first 10-plus innings, and he was like, oh, look, the Cubs got another nifty back-end guy. And since then, he has had four starts. He allowed six runs against the Brewers on April 18th. That was in 3 2/3 innings. Next time out, he allowed three runs in six innings. That's a quality start, right? Except he also walked six batters and allowed five hits. The Pirates kind of let him off the hook there. In his last two starts, he hasn't even completed two innings. However, he has found time to be charitable, allowing 13 hits, 12 runs, all earned, walking one and striking out two. So he has been an absolute disaster lately. And Mike Montgomery, I'm not a huge believer in his ability to transition to the rotation. However, he cannot be worse than this right now. So it's a rough time for the Cubs in terms of getting length out of the rotation and in terms of having to fill in the now vacant spots in the rotation.
Yeah, the thing about Anderson is I don't think anyone really thinks that this is an injury issue that's causing him to go to the disabled list. It seems like this is more of a 10-day disabled list with the case of the bad. And they just needed to get him out of the rotation, give him a breather, let him work on a few things. And they're not going to send him to the minor leagues to do that. So this is probably the next best option. Now, I know there is some notice of a back issue, and that could have made him worse for sure. So,
yeah, I mean, whiplash is a real thing, right?
Right.
But no, Brian, are you suggesting that teams might screw the rules a little bit to benefit themselves? Is that
no. I would never suggest something like that. I would say it right out. They're lying
by golly
all the time.
Willikers. We're breaking news here.
Right. It'll be fun to see who winds up in this fifth spot, because it's going to be fun to see the Cubs, you know, not go into a game with them as the kind of the favorite team walking into it. Yeah.
I hope it's Eddie Butler.
Eddie Butts is he's not pitching all that well in AAA. He's one of those below five strikeout per nine guys, a la Jared Weaver. So, and he's never had a good strikeout rate in the majors and the minors, despite his prospect pedigree. So it'd kind of be fun to see him get out there and put some balls in play and see if that vaunted Cubs defense can pick him up.
Yes, let's do it. I mean, that could lead to some pretty short games in theory. So yeah, let's do that.
All right, it's decided.
Okay. Go for it, Eddie Butts.
So James Tallien on the 10-day groin discomfort. With as bad as a beginning of the season as we've seen from the Pittsburgh Pirates, who do you think finishes with a better record, the Pirates or the Brewers?
That is a good question, Sean. I mean, Tallien's been pitching pretty good, so I mean, this is a blow for him, but the Brewers, I don't know if I want to count out Eric Thames as bad, or Thames, I always mispronounce it, as bad as that Brewers kind of the rotation and what I would expect from them. I'm starting to think that it might be the Brewers, but I think I still have to land on the side of the Pirates. I just think they have better overall talent. Their starting rotation's a little bit better, and they still do have a couple of really kind of star level players on the Pirates side. I don't know though. It's a lot closer than I would have thought at the beginning of the season.
I think the Brewers are more likely to just kind of disassemble their rotation, which would lead to, I mean, you know, Guerra, he gets back. He's like guaranteed to be a Los Angeles Dodger by the end of the season. I think Chase Anderson and Zach Davies can draw interest from contenders as, you know, kind of boring number four types or slightly better. Yeah, I mean, the Pirates, I think they're going to try and hang in here as long as possible. And they still might make some trades to kind of disassemble things. But I think, yeah, I think I'll go with the Pirates, but I don't think it's going to be by much, even if both teams, you know, decide to sell off a little bit. I think it's going to be pretty close. I'll go with Pirates, but I'm probably going to regret that. I don't know. I'm trying not to talk myself out of it, but yeah, I'm not really a believer in either roster being like good at this point, but I'm not really certain that there's a huge separation. So that's disappointing.
TBD. Ask us again in a month, Sean.
Ask me again in early October and I will give you the right answer. I promise you.
It's almost like you should wait more than a month into baseball before guessing that. So
I'm out of the Pirates.
So our last disabled stint, Adrian Gonzalez, to the 10-day right elbow soreness. This is the move that really gave Cody Bellinger some playing time. So how long do we think until Adrian Gonzalez is relegated to a bench spot?
You know, I don't know if they would actually bench him right away. I think he comes back, and the way these things work out, like we've talked about the Dodgers before and their outfield situation, and there always seems to be an injury there. So they'll probably time it where Bellinger can slide to a corner right as Gonzalez returns. They'll give Gonzalez some time to try to work the rust off, work the stink off, and go from there. But it's hard for me to see them benching him anytime soon, not just because of the contract, but because, you know, he seems like a clubhouse leader type, or at least not a clubhouse leader, like at least a strong presence in the clubhouse. And we saw how he reacted to the WBC. Imagine if he comes back and is benched after, like, you know, one bad month, basically. Like, I just can't see that going well for them. And I think they will handle this with some care by not benching him right out of the gate once he returns.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me, RJ. The one thing I'll point out real quickly, in the past 11 seasons, Gonzalez with the Padres and with the Red Sox and with the Dodgers has played in 156 or more games in every season until now, where I assume he will not play 156 games. That durability, I think, is one of his most useful skills, even beyond his power and his contact ability. The fact that he, up until right now, has basically never been on the disabled list and never needed to miss time like this. It sounds like he's going to be on the DL for longer than 10 days, which is not ideal. The big worry I have about Gonzalez is the zero dingers up to this point in the season in 29 games. His power kind of faded a little bit last year. If it's fading more now, he's such a bad base runner. He's not what I would consider an elite fielder anymore. And it's probably the time for the Dodgers to start to think about the plan B, whether it's Bellinger or somebody else at first base. A bench role might be coming for Gonzalez. It just doesn't seem like this is the right time for the Dodgers to do it, especially, you know, midseason, especially with an injury kind of hanging over his head. And especially with Bellinger, although he's been playing very well, he's not exactly a Lou Gehrig playing in front of Wally Pipp sort of situation right now. So I think they'll be kind of cautious and careful with him, but I think we may be near the end of Gonzalez's time as a regular starter, maybe move him into some sort of platoon role or something like that. It also happens to be Adrian Gonzalez's birthday today. So
happy birthday, Adrian. We were talking about you. You were probably no longer an effective big league player, but hey, if this is it, I mean, heck of a career. 14 seasons, a 132 OPS plus, some legitimate MVP worthy, at least MVP discussion worthy years, especially with the Padres. I mean, he really was a hell of a hitter for a number of years there, and not just in terms of, you know, the power and the average, but he had a great approach at the plate. And like you said, he was an outstanding defender, just a really, really good player, and probably a lot better career than anyone would have gave him the expectation of having, given he was, you know, even though he was a first overall pick, he was traded to Texas and then he was traded to San Diego before he really had a regular year. So in the majors, that is. So yeah, outstanding career, and one that, again, despite the lofty expectations on draft day, he didn't necessarily seem destined for until he was in his mid-20s.
And one more, my favorite Adrian Gonzalez fact. If you look at his 2011 season with the Boston Red Sox, he was such a bad base runner that year. Every measure that you can find has him worth almost a full win in the negative as a base runner, which is unbelievable to imagine. How bad do you have to be to cost your team 10 or more runs as a just on the base path? So Adrian Gonzalez, fabulous.
He wasn't paid to run, Brian.
That's true.
He was not fabulous, paid to run.
Fabulous career, unbelievable hitter. Had a .410 on base percentage that year, but man, he must have just made so many outs on the bases that season, because
he grounded into 28 double plays that year.
There you go. That's part of it for sure.
That he actually had more double plays grounded into than home runs, and he hit 27 home runs. So that's not something a lot of people can say. So again, congratulations, Adrian.
Yeah, happy 35th, Adrian Gonzalez. Please don't be mad at us for the slightly negative look at your future, but you had a heck of a pass. Four-time Gold Glover, five-time All-Star. Been in the MVP discussion, I think 8 times he's received MVP votes. So good on you, Adrian.
So moving on, we talked earlier about service time manipulation or GM manipulation. And we'll focus on that here with the Reds' Amir Garrett being optioned to AAA.
I mean, Garrett's been kind of a fun and interesting guy to watch at the start of the season. He's got the prospect pedigree. I'm not sure that this is anything more than the trying to manipulate the service time, just like you said, because he's been pitching not well, but well enough since coming up with the Reds. It's not like the Reds have better options behind him for the starting rotation. So it seems like it's a bit of a manipulation issue. I don't know. What do you think, RJ?
I think that's probably the cynical but correct way of viewing it. I believe the team line will be that they're just trying to limit his innings, limit his workload, make it more manageable. But whether that's the case or not, I mean, just to refresh everybody, if he's only down for like 20 days, he's still going to get credit for all that service time. So they have to keep him down for longer than 20 days throughout the season in order for him to A, burn an option, and B, not receive service time for all the, all the games and days he misses. So I'm not sure what their plan is here, but just to note, like, his career high in innings as a professional is 144 2/3. So, and that was set last season, just to be clear. And they've kind of brought him along where it looks like almost a 10% increase per season. So if they're going to do that, he's already at 36 through 6 starts. Realistically, he's probably going to spend some more time in the minors, and he'll probably end up missing out on some service time. But yeah, just keep that in mind when a team sends down a guy like this. If it's a short-term assignment, he's going to get credit for that service time. It has to be more than 20 days to even burn an option. So just keep that in mind, that it's not necessarily going to be beneficial to the team in any way other than the innings aspect if it's a short assignment. So we'll see.
I hope he comes back soon. I like watching him pitch. It's a lot better than some of the other options in Cincinnati. I mean, would you rather watch him make some starts, or would you rather, I don't know, Sal Romano come up and make some starts, or Lizaverto Bonilla, or
you just wanted to say their names. You're not fooling anyone.
No, not at all. I mean, even like, Tim Adelman's a great story, but we need another Bronson Arroyo start. I think we need a kick in the head. So come back soon.
Hey, now that's the first place Cincinnati Reds.
That's hilarious.
The Reds, sure, 17-14 on the year, a half game up on the St. Louis Cardinals in the NL Central. So our next topic last week, and in the first three episodes, really, we've talked about Tommy Malone, Ty Kelly, and Mike Clevenger. All have had some news this week, so we'll come back to them. Tommy Malone was claimed by the Mets. Ty Kelly was optioned to AAA, and Mike Clevenger was called up for Cleveland. So which of these moves is going to have the biggest impact?
obviously, Ty Kelly to AAA. I mean, Brian, I just told you last week I really like the Tommy Malone signing from Milwaukee, so congratulations. You have ample reason to pay attention to him now, and obviously it's Clevenger. I mean, you know, realistically, Malone is not going to, well, hopefully not going to play an important part for the Mets. And Kelly is, you know, Kelly transcends big league baseball. So what a mess.
he's greater than all of us. Yeah, I mean, I think Malone is going to be much better for the Mets than Adam Wilk was yesterday. So that's damning with very faint praise. Ty Kelly, is kind of a class to himself. Clevinger came up, made his first start, making a spot start on Sunday. He pitched 5 2/3 innings. He struck out 5 Royals in that time, and he gave up no runs. So that's a pretty much ideal Mike Clevinger start. What makes it a Mike Clevinger start is because he also walked, I believe, 4 guys in 5 2/3 innings. He's a walk machine. Got some really interesting stuff, but I think he could do fine in an extended role. He'll just need to limit that as much as possible, because if he can just limit his walks, he'll be a perfectly effective back of the rotation or even mid rotation kind of starter. And he's been pitching well for the Cleveland's AAA team so far. 30 innings pitched, he's striking out more than a batter per 9, and he had a 1.5 ERA in the minors. So I'm still rooting for the guy. I'm still hoping that he gets to stick this time. But if not, you've always got Ryan Merritt waiting in the wings, just like RJ likes.
Yes.
So the Twins.
Don't need them crappy lefties.
So the Twins DFA'd Danny Santana, which matches a couple of moves where they've DFA'd Michael Tonkin and Kyle Gibson, both optioned to AAA by the Minnesota Twins. So is the new front office actually trying to make moves to let the Twins win baseball games?
No. I do like that we went from crafty lefties to the Minnesota Twins. But, I mean, look, they brought up Nick Tepesh to replace Kyle Gibson, and he got absolutely smoked by the Red Sox. I mean, you know, Jose Berrios, if he would have came up, maybe. But I think the Twins are being realistic here that they're not quite as good as the record suggests, and they're going to play the long game here. And these moves, you know, Gibson is really the only one of the three that matters long term. Like, Santana has not been an effective big league player in years. Tonkin, yeah, so Gibson is the important part there, and even he's perhaps not as important as you would think. He's older than you'd think. Like, how old do y'all think Kyle Gibson is? If, don't look, just guess. How old do you think he is?
25.
32.
That would be my guess. Okay.
He is 32. Okay, see, I was expecting 27 at most. He's actually 29. He'll turn 30 in October.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, how much chicken is left on the bone there, you know? So I think he's the most important part of it, and we're talking about a guy who has an 85 ERA plus in 600 big league innings, and he's going to turn 30 in a few months. So, but, of course, they brought up Nick Tepesh, who, though younger than Kyle Gibson, has been even worse during his limited big league time. So I don't think these are about winning. I think it's maybe about trying to salvage a little bit out of Gibson. And otherwise, yeah, it's about playing the long game still.
I was kind of interested in the Santana DFA, because that to me does seem like a very new regime sort of move, because like you mentioned before, Santana hasn't been particularly good. He's been an extreme low walk guy. Makes pretty good contact, but not great content. But he's exactly the kind of Twinsy utility, gritty, not particularly very good hitter type of player, with the exception of his 2014, where he hit, like, you know, just incredibly well off over 400 BABIP. He's been pretty bad in 2015 and 2016, and not particularly good in the minors either. But he always seemed like the kind of guy the Twins front office was really into because of his kind of secondary skills. And seeing the team finally move on from that and, you know, focusing on some other, you know, actually being a good hitter perhaps, or trying to move on and get somebody else in there, I think is a new regime sort of move, and it's probably about time for that. So it was kind at least interesting to me.
Although they still have Ara Adrianza there, and he's not too dissimilar, is he? I feel like
no.
he's obviously not really playing either, and that might be the difference. You know, the old regime might have played him, whereas this one is like, I think he has like 4 plate appearances. maybe a little bit more now. I don't. But yeah, you're right. That's a good point, that perhaps this Twins front office is a little less emotionally connected to players who had good seasons 2 or 3 years ago, and kind of fit the mold. So That's disappointing if you're Danny Santana.
Yeah.
Sorry, Danny.
So moving from sort of youth to now older players, Drew Stubbs DFA'd by the Giants in a move that sent Justin Ruggiano to the bigs. And I have a little Ruggiano story. Last year, I believe it was in early July, Ruggiano was with the Rangers AAA team, the Round Rock Express, and I was at a game in Dell Diamond, and I saw him hit two home runs in the seven-inning game, and the second was a walk-off in the seventh.
Wow.
And I didn't think Ruggiano could hit home runs like that, but apparently he's got something left, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Ruggiano has always been more of a stat-head favorite than anything because, you know, he always struck out a lot in the minors, and he didn't really get a chance in Tampa Bay, which is not really a comment you want to make after saying he was a stat-head favorite. But, you know, he's had moments where he's looked like a useful platoon outfielder slash fourth outfielder. He had the nickname Scrooge in AAA years ago because he's kind of, I mean, you know, he's surly, but he's also seemingly intelligent and realistic about how baseball works and all. And, I mean, you look at his track record, he's bounced around so much. Even last season with the Mets, I mean, the numbers were good. It was a small sample, and there's no reason to think he is really that productive of a player anymore. But he's always been someone who seems to produce and then gets tossed aside like 5 minutes later. So I think this is – I mean, it speaks volumes that we're talking about. We've talked about Aaron Hill playing the outfield, and we're talking about Drew Stubbs, and Ruggiano's just now getting that chance after – you know, Mike Morse got his chance, and after, you know, Melvin Emmanuel Upton got injured, and yeah, he's not in a good position career-wise, and this is probably going to be his last dance in the majors, if I had to guess.
Yeah, he hadn't been playing well in AAA at all, mm-hmm. which is a bad sign, of course. His short run with the Mets last year was pretty magical, and it's given him a nice little 2016 stat line, but you're right. He's just about cooked, it seems like.
Play well in AAA last year either. 745 OPS plus, OPS. So,
yeah, I will always remember him for his comment. I think it was on Twitter when they were talking about needing a center fielder in Miami when he was back with the Marlins. And he said something like, "I got this," when they needed a center fielder. And he kind of did, but not from a defensive standpoint. He was never his confidence outstripped his glove, I think, a little bit, which is a story of quite a number of ball players, but I'll never forget him saying, you know, "I got this" in center field, kind of taking over the center field role for the Marlins and not exactly succeeding to the best of what he had hoped for.
Moving on now, Rangers call up Austin Bibben-Dirks and DFA Dario Alvarez.
I mean, congratulations on pronouncing his name. That's been my biggest fear coming into this.
So the interesting one here is Dario Alvarez. Sorry, Austin. But Alvarez actually had some interest in him last season because he's a low arm slot lefty with a very good slider. And if you look at the numbers throughout his time in the majors, regular season only, Rooks Baseball has him throwing like 60% sliders. And the reason for that is because batters have whiffed on 46.81% of their swings. The problem is his fastball hasn't been very effective whatsoever, even though it's in the low 90s. But if the Rangers have soured on him, and if this eventually leads to him hitting the waiver wire, don't be surprised if a team like the Rays or even the Mets pick him up again. Well, I mean, I know he's already been with the Mets, but you never know. He might come back there. Even the Pirates, I could see them. Like, it seems like a lot of these teams, there's like a small cluster of teams that just kind of cycle the same players in and out. I don't know if y'all have noticed that, but like, even if you think about the Rays and the Mets, Adam Wilk was with the Rays last year. Now he's with the Mets. You know, Donna Evelyn was with the Mets, and now he was with the Rays. And it just seems like they seem to swap these same players out, perhaps because of their spin rates or whatever metric they're all chasing nowadays. But, yeah, that's my prediction here, that Dario Alvarez will land on a Sabre-friendly team by year's end.
Yeah, I don't have much to add about Alvarez. I do think he is one of those guys where, you know, the Rangers bullpen was supposed to be so good that he was kind of on the fringes of it when he looked like an interesting pitcher, and for him to be, you know, kind of tossed aside for, I mean, not a prospect at all, not a guy who'd been tearing up even AAA. but rather a guy in ABD, as I will call him, because I don't want to deal with his last name. He's more of a swingman type guy, a guy who can be a starter and a reliever. It's a little surprising to me. I will say I'm really excited for Bevan Dirks because he's a 32-year-old journeyman who probably wasn't going to get much of a chance in the majors if it weren't for this call-up. I know he's pitched in the minors for the Mariners, the Cubs, the Nationals, the Rockies, the Jays, and the Rangers. And, kind of going into, I think this is his age 32 season, just had a birthday a little while back. So for one of those guys who's kind of a grinder, who's spent a lot of time in the minors, it's really nice for him to get his shot and get his per diem and at least be able to tell the story of playing for this, god-awful Rangers team in 2017.
He's probably already had conversations about whether this would be his last year. You know, he's at that point in his career where, you know, it's time to start talking about what you're going to do once you're done pitching. So for him to get this call now is really fantastic, not only for him, but, you know, just from a human interest perspective.
Yeah, I mean, he actually pitched for Lancaster in the Atlantic League last year. He was actually out of affiliated ball for a little bit. So coming back and making it back to the majors, I'm really happy for him.
That's a dude who loves baseball because, you know, you're willing to go down there at that age. That's really, it's remarkable.
And he hasn't been awful in Round Rock this season. 3.04 ERA, 20 strikeouts, which relative, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, being okay in Round Rock is actually better than okay. So that's not too bad.
So our last topic now, we've talked a lot in our first four shows about the Rangers, Mets, and Mariners and how many roster moves they've had to make. All of those three teams have been really dealing with injuries and play and stuff that factor into making a lot of roster moves. So I'll ask you two this. Which team ends up making more roster moves at the end of the season? Rangers, Mets, or Mariners?
Mariners, because the Mets won't make the moves. You know, they don't want to use the DL, so they're out by default. And, I mean, Jerry DePoto's not going to lose a roster off to John Daniels. You know, come on. It's definitely the Mariners.
Yeah, the only thing I can think about is that the Rangers could make a late push if they have a span of bad injuries, or if they decide to really sell off and we get into the kind of the Yu Darvish sweepstakes, maybe they'd move him or Shinsu Chu or somebody else like that. But how do you bet against Jerry DePoto? I mean, I think you'd have to be a crazy person to. The Mariners could also get into a sell-off mode, and if that's the case, then, you know, all bets are off. I mean, what we've seen so far is Jerry DePoto trying to be competitive. Can you imagine the kind of moves that would be made if he was in a rebuilding mode? I mean, I would have to imagine that this entire roster would churn over two or three times in one offseason.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a kid on sugar high playing MLB The Show. You know, it would just be complete and utter deconstruction. But yeah, I don't think you can bet against Jerry DePoto unless, like, the ghost of Alex Anthopoulos takes over the Rangers or Mets of the next week or two. And even then, it's going to be DePoto.
Yeah. DePoto all the way.
Is there any dark horse who could unseat DePoto?
The Dodgers are always making roster moves, but I don't think it'll be them. Pirates and Rays probably won't do enough to merit those kind of roster moves, so probably not them. No, I think it's DePoto.
I would be sticking in the AL West for the only other option. I think the Athletics tend to be creative, which these days might be a mild euphemism for making some really questionable choices, but they don't have enough star level players on their roster to have anybody that they'd want to keep, I feel like. Yeah. And they might be willing to get a little experimental. So that's the only other team I could see coming close, really. No, it's going to be the Mariners.
Yep. Definitely the Mariners.
And I mean, the Athletics have at least five or six roster moves left for them just by moving Adam Rosales back to the Rangers and forth.
That's yes. True, but that works for both teams. You know, maybe DePoto will get in on this time, so who knows?
Adam Rosales just had a game-winning hit a few nights ago, boys. Let's show some respect. My favorite Adam Rosales thing, and I realize saying my favorite Adam Rosales thing qualifies me for a lot of bad list out there, but that he runs on home runs, walks, whatever. Like, That's so adorable, really. It's really adorable. So good on you, Adam Rosales. Thank you for making baseball a little more fun in a weird way.
My favorite Adam Rosales thing, because everybody has one, everybody has a favorite Adam
Oh,
Rosales
yes.
thing, is probably his in 2015, he played more games for Texas as a pitcher than he did as a left fielder. That's probably my favorite thing.
Okay, here's the
Yet.
thing. That's not like a well-known Adam Rosales thing, and we did not discuss that we were going to talk about Adam Rosales. So you've been carrying that nugget around, just waiting for a conversation about Adam Rosales and our favorite things about Adam Rosales to come up in order to drop that. So,
Yeah,
see,
that's
that's not normal, Brian. Mine is relatively normal compared to yours. You are certifiable.
yeah, that's no argument for me there,
Oh
but I
my.
this is from my tracking of players who play multiple positions for the Mick Ewing score. I have my eye on Adam Rosales and what positions he's playing all at all times. Yeah, Rosales, he's amazing. Also, just to point it out, I believe Adam Rosales' career ERA is 9 ERA, but
Yes.
he does have 4.5 strikeouts per nine, so you gotta
Yeah,
respect
it's only a 16.63 fielding independent pitching. So,
that.
if he doesn't keep allowing two home runs per nine, he will be prime position to drop that ERA down just slightly. So, I cannot
Adam
believe we
Rosales.
have Adam Rosales fun facts here, and you broke out one that's so specific. That's wow. See, I'm doing a podcast of an Adam Rosales fanatic and a person who allows their cat to drive their car. So.
Do you guys remember back in 2013 when Rosales hit that home run in Cleveland and it hit off the railing and they wouldn't give him the home run?
No,
I don't remember
how
that.
would anybody remember
No,
that, John?
I don't. It was one of the big rules that shifted towards using replay, and it was a ball he hit to left field and the high wall hit off the railing. They went and looked at it. Everybody talked about it. The replay clearly showed it hit off the railing, and then they gave him a home run. Adam Rosales had four home runs that year. He would have had his fifth home run, and they just took it away from
I mean, that would have changed his entire career arc right there. That one home run would have.
We never know. Man, that is the best possible way to end this show, I feel like. That was very good. I can't believe everybody had something.
I think about that Rosales homer a lot.
I can tell.
What is wrong with you? Oh my God.
Me see. I'll drop a video. I know I gotta have a video in here somewhere.
Oh, yeah, just send that to me at some point and I'll put it in the post for the show.
Jesus, man. Adam Rosales. Wow. What is wrong with us? I cannot believe we just.
Riffed on Adam Rosales for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, here's the thing. I saw someone. There's this fantasy writer out there. She writes every single time she writes about players. She mentions like the fly ball right and on. I saw her in spring training be like, Adam Rosales is having a good spring, but don't be concerned because his fly ball rate was higher. Or like, keep an eye on him because his fly ball rate was higher last year, and that has stuck with me as like the prime example of why you do not just look at fly ball rate to judge power potential. And that's why I mentioned the Billy Hamilton thing. Like, people out there are doing this, and that drives me crazy that they're literally just being like, oh, he hits fly balls, so power must be coming. Like, no, you don't want Adam Rosales hitting fly balls in that park. Don't even worry about his batted ball profile. If you're playing him enough to worry about that, you have bigger issues. You know? I sound frantic right now. I am like shaken to my core about this.
I'm watching the results. I thought they didn't have replay that year yet, but they went and watched the replay, saw it hit the railing, and still didn't give him
Great, great injustice of our time. We're on our
Oh.
deathbeds. You know, what could we have done with these 10 minutes we spent? St.
Today.
Peter is going to be replaced by Adam Rosales because, you know, he's a great utility man. So we'll come up there and he'll be like, do you think it was a home run or not? And I'm gonna be like, he was absolutely a home run. He's gonna grant me access. So that's what this conversation has done for us. We're well positioned to enter Adam Rosales' heaven.
That's so funny. Like, I love the fact that Adam Rosales is such a utility man that he also took a position at in heaven. That's fantastic.
Let's use that. Let's not even for an intro. Let's just use that as the intro. That little Adam Rosales heaven part. See how many viewers actually, you know, stick with it after that. Because I feel like it would be three, maybe four, including the cat. And even the cat might find something better to do, you know?
Today is the 4-year anniversary of that home run, by the way. Just
Wait, today is the
like
4-year
anniversary. I just noticed that. May 8th, 2013.
All right, I'm changing what I'm doing.
I'm pretty sure. Let me double check because I'm like 90% positive today is that day. That is amazing. Oh my.
No, that, I mean, that looks right to me. This was published on May 9th and yes. The game was from May 8th. So yes, today was, wow. Adam yep. Rosales is in heaven pulling these strings.
Oh, that's beautiful.
We randomly brought up Adam Rosales and each of us had a heartfelt, important story and fact to share about our love for Adam Rosales. So well done, gentlemen. I think
he doesn't walk off. He runs off.
Oh, that's a show for you. So thank you very much for listening. DFA Podcast, you can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can find us on Baseball Prospectus. You can find RJ's work at CBS Sports. You can find Sean's at BP Mets and at Beyond the Box Score, and mine, of course, at Baseball Prospectus. But thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.